Thank you very much, Marama. Kia ora. Welcome to the panel on RNZ National. I'm Karen Hay. I'm in for Wallace Chapman this week, and our panellists today are Amy Adams, former National Party Minister. Amy, sorry to have interrupted you before the news there. I didn't want to minimise what you were saying. It was the Egyptian chap who plays table tennis with his feet.
Yeah, it looked just incredible. And I mean, as I say, nothing like it for showing you that the things we think are problems are really nothing.
And Alan Blackman, Professor of Chemistry at AUT, and lots of response to what you said about nuclear weapons, Alan.
Oh dear.
This says, thanks, Alan. The reality is ignored because it is existentially insupportable. Go figure. And AJ says, I hear what Dr. Blackman is saying, but I'd rather worry about the more likely threat that is climate change, which will definitely reduce quality of life in future if we don't change. Sure, nuclear annihilation doesn't sound great, but it's not happened in 70 years, so lower probability. Cheers from AJ. If you'd like to text, the number is 2101 and let us know what you think. It's now 8 minutes past four, and an interim all-male Taliban government has been announced for Afghanistan, and observers say it's comprised of hardline senior figures who served in similar roles decades ago, and several who are listed by the United States and the United Nations as global terrorists. For example, the new Interior Minister, Shahrazuddin Haqqani, he's on the FBI's most wanted list, and I've seen the poster. The United States Department of State is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information directly leading to his arrest. Well, they know where to find him. And whilst the Taliban are now free to appoint who they like without international interference, the key problem they're going to have in the country is avoiding an economic meltdown by losing support from the international community. And to discuss this, Otago University Professor of Politics and International Relations, Robert Patman. Kia ora, Robert.
Kia ora. Kia ora.
This is supposedly a temporary lineup for the Afghanistan government, but there's no indication that there's going to be a democratic election.
No, it has been cast as a temporary caretaker government, but as your introductory comments suggest, it's not exactly reassuring to the international community. No women included in the government, and also a number of really hardline figures in key ministries, such as the defence, and also, as you mentioned in your introductory comments, Interior Minister.
So how is the international community reacting to this temporary government lineup?
Well, as far as I know, there hasn't been a definitive response. The Americans just said that they would judge the new Taliban caretaker government by its actions rather than its words, which I think was a bit of an allusion to the fact that the Taliban were seeking to reassure everyone before they took over the full reins of government, which of course may be, you know, if you're cynical, you would say they were just talking in a moderate fashion in order not to encounter any obstacles to consolidating their power. They now have a chance to run the country and they face enormous challenges.
Where does Afghanistan's budget come from? Is my understanding correct that it's 80% of it comes from the international community?
Yes. Afghanistan's one of the poorest states in the world, and it's dependent on foreign aid for about 20% of its gross income. And to make things worse, excuse me, the US froze $9.5 billion of the Afghan Central Bank's assets, which were in the United States, while the International Monetary Fund has suspended access to funds for the new Taliban government. So I suppose the Taliban could be described as being desperate for international legitimacy, at least on the face of it, in order to make their job running Afghanistan easier, i.e. to unlock those funds. But at the moment, their lineup doesn't seem to be addressing that problem. It's difficult to see how the new lineup will help the whole process of getting international legitimacy. It certainly doesn't seem to help with domestic legitimacy. And it doesn't seem to help in terms of uniting the country. One of the notable things is the new cabinet is heavily dominated by the Pashtun ethnic group, which makes up about 40% of Afghan's total population. So there are all sorts of problems facing this new caretaker government.
So I know women in the lineup, and before this overthrow by the Taliban, women made up more than a quarter of parliamentarians. And by 2016, the stats say that more than 150,000 women in Afghanistan had been elected to local office. So how can the international community ensure women's rights in a society that's fundamentally opposed to upholding them?
Well, that's the problem. The government, the new government, have said they will acknowledge women's rights in as much as they fit in with Sharia law, which is pretty repressive, as was demonstrated last time the Taliban was in power. So it is a major problem. And the other thing is the Taliban don't seem to be particularly responsive, if past evidence is anything to go by, to international pressure. We also lack clear voice internationally on such matters. The UN Security Council is pretty divided, and both China and Russia, key members of the Security Council, seem to be trying to win favour with the Taliban, and are prepared. They're authoritarian regimes, and they're unlikely to stand up for women's rights if it means getting closer to the Taliban.
Thanks, Robert. Amy, the Taliban stated they wanted to grant women's rights, but as Robert said, according to Sharia law, but it's obvious by this interim appointment that women's rights have been rolled right back 20 years.
Yeah, it is. And it's not surprising. I think it's what we all expected and feared, but it's incredibly disappointing. And I mean, disappointing is not really enough of a word, is it? It beggars belief. We're sitting here where we do in New Zealand, that women would not only not be represented, but face having such an enormous infringement of their basic rights. I mean, you know, we can't, I guess, project our Western norms onto them, but I think anyone would struggle to say that women shouldn't have a voice and the right to basic human freedoms. And I think we all know that that's not going to be the case for women in Afghanistan, and it's devastating.
Ellen, in your view, would something like economic sanctions be enough to bring the Taliban into line?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but I was just wondering what happened the last time that the Taliban were in power. Were the IMF and the US similarly putting sanctions on them then? And, you know, somehow they did manage to survive until George Bush did his thing with them. The whole place is just an absolute bloody tragedy. And if any of the listeners want to read a really, really good book about the history of all of this stuff, a thing called The Great Game by Peter Hopkirk goes right back to sort of when Britain was first involved, sort of in the 19th century. And just, you know, any Western powers that try and do anything in there, they just end up getting beaten back. And I don't know what the world can do. I think it's an absolute tragedy for the majority of the population in Afghanistan. I think it's terrible. What's going to happen? I don't know. Sanctions, yeah, but, you know, as you say, they're pretty poor anyway. So is that going to make an enormous difference?
What's your response to that, Robert?
No, I would agree with Alan. I think the situation at the moment is really desperate in Afghanistan. And a couple of other things that we should add to the mix is that Afghanistan, because it's been subject to the dislocation of a civil war going on many years, there's lots of displaced people, there's a shortage of food, and also the country's been ravaged by COVID-19. And according to the UN, Afghanistan's on the verge of a major humanitarian catastrophe. So it's important the international community maintains contact with Afghanistan. After all, we shouldn't penalise the Afghan people because the Taliban have seized power from what was an elected government, albeit a corrupt government, and one which was unable to basically stay the course against the Taliban.
Robert, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Otago University Professor of Politics and International Relations, Robert Patman. It's now 17 minutes past four, and New Zealand's event sector says it's working with officials on a possible government-funded pandemic insurance plan. The UK government is one of the first in the world to roll out this insurance scheme for live events that are cancelled, postponed or relocated as a result of COVID-19 restrictions, and it's come at a cost of £750 million. With me is Stu Hartley. He's the underwriting manager at Kiwi-based events insurance company Event Cover. Kia ora, Stu.
Kia ora, Kevin. How are you?
Do you think our government's open to a pandemic insurance plan like the one that the UK has introduced?
Initial conversations don't appear to suggest that, no. But those conversations are still ongoing. It's a moving beast. The goalposts are changing globally on a day-by-day basis. As you just mentioned then, the UK government have proposed putting forward £750 million worth of cover. Obviously, New Zealand is not looking for anything close to that mark.
But what do you ask?
Indications. Well, it's really difficult to say. Obviously, the event sector here in NZ is quite a lot smaller than the UK. But even £750 million is not a lot. When you're talking about, so far, Lloyd's of London have suffered losses, specifically for the events industry, close to £5 billion.
So what are you asking our government for, though? You must have put a figure on it at some point.
Well, it's not that we've been asking for a figure. What we had proposed was, this was prior to the UK scheme being mentioned, we'd actually put forward a proposition, which was, at the time, or two or three months ago, the only product available. And that was close to $20 million. So, again, not kind of a huge figure, but at that time, it was the only level of cover which was available.
So what happens now? What's the situation at the moment for event organisers? What happens to them when their event is cancelled?
Well, it's not just ourselves here in NZ. It's any event organiser around the world. At the moment, there just is no commercial availability for cover. Following a cancellation due to COVID-19. So from our clients, there's just a huge amount of uncertainty and fear in the market. It's very, very difficult to plan an event, which obviously events don't take days to plan, they take months and years. So there's a lot of uncertainty and fear there, especially for events which are coming up to the summer.
So COVID is written out of the contract. There's no cover for COVID.
No, so what it was prior to COVID, we'd never really obviously discussed COVID. What we had in the standard policies around the world was what's called communicable disease, and that was readily available. We stopped including communicable disease up to probably as late as middle March, when the World Health Organization classified it as a pandemic. From that stage onwards, it was therefore just totally unavailable.
So with this $20 million, what would you want to see covered?
Well, what was put forward was, it was looking for events to have the ability to be able to proceed, not cancel. It was looking for them to have the ability to be able to reschedule or postpone to a later date. And again, it was a very niche specific level of cover. And what that would allow would be effectively the insurance would cover up to a certain level any additional costs which the event organizer would have to fork out to move that event to another date.
Thanks, Stu. Amy, do you think the government should be propping up these schemes?
I think the government should certainly be looking very closely at the impact it has. I mean, COVID, we know, is a massive economic effect across many, many sectors. But, you know, we seem to make allowances for sports games and certain sort of shows. But the event sector is far bigger than I think people realise. And it's just the uncertainty. It's not even the number of lockdowns or the length of them. People planning 6, 9, 12 months out are saying, can we really go ahead and take the chance that we're going to be able to operate in this environment? I think the number of times that sort of insurance would actually be called on is probably pretty low, but the effect of not having it is that a huge number of events are potentially not going to go ahead, and that is massive, not just economically actually, but just for social cohesion.
Yeah, a text here says, "Hi, sadly, I just got an email to say the show I had booked for in Christchurch has been cancelled. The Buddy Holly show has been rescheduled from last year. Sure, I now know I will get a refund. My hotel is now cancelled and a credit issued by Air New Zealand for my return flight from Dunedin to Christchurch, level 2. But sure, it's still tough for some." So that person has, you know, been made whole to a great degree, but the promoter or the events person, what's going to happen to them?
It would be difficult to say. It would be probably, there would be a lot of irrecoverable costs for putting on that event. And then obviously there's the gap there on the profit that they would have made. So, I mean, these event professionals are hurting. As Amy rightly said, the effect of an event being cancelled is a lot greater than just that one individual event. Events drive tourism, and there'll be a lot of regions which will be really hurting off the back of the troubles that the event space are going through.
Alan, do you have sympathy for the events industry? Do you think the government should be putting in $20 million, as Stu suggested?
Well, I just, a couple of hours ago, got an email saying that a conference that I was going to be a speaker at in November has just been cancelled, and they've postponed it until next year. So it's not only sports events and, you know, and shows and stuff like that. There's also, as somebody said, you know, the events industry is obviously very big. I'm going to say something possibly very controversial here. I was looking up the two biggest insurance companies in New Zealand, and combined, over the year to June this year, their profits were over $500 million. And dare I say it, the insurance industry is, you know, happy to take our premiums when times are good. But when times aren't quite so good, then, you know, maybe they could be a little bit more understanding. But that's just my view.
And your response, Stu?
from a personal perspective, I couldn't really not agree with that. Obviously, event insurance is a very, very niche sector, and any contingency insurance is often covered from Lloyd's over in the UK. As I mentioned, they've suffered way in excess of $5 billion worth of claims. So as far as I'm aware, it's possibly the largest claim that Lloyd's in its entire history has had to go through. So the entire insurance industry is certainly hurting off the back of this.
If you were just insuring an event outside of COVID and it fell over, what are the sums that we're talking about? How much does it cost you to have a policy like that?
It can actually be quite cheap. So aside from COVID, the usual risk that an event professional will be looking at, here in New Zealand really would be obviously the adverse weather. Obviously, the climate can change across the regions. And we underwrite that based on the historical probability of that weather event happening. And it can be quite cheap. I mean, minimum premiums start around $600. And then we go up to, you know, the large events like the America's Cup, for example, which obviously the premiums can be significant. But really the misunderstanding is, that it's quite expensive to insure this, when actually it's not. As Amy mentioned, you know, there's not huge amounts of losses that we see in the event space. The Kiwi mentality is that we'll kind of get on with things and, you know, she'll be right. So we actually do really kick on, but obviously a lot of people's hands are tied at the moment and they just are unable to proceed with these events.
And Greg texts to say, can you ask Amy how the government putting dollars into propping up the events industry sits with her previous political position where the market determines all? That's from Greg in Christchurch.
It's always one. No, look, I'm not saying they should prop them up. I'm saying that some form of underwriting, some form of confidence gives them an ability to get on and do it for themselves. This isn't actually big handouts. It's saying, look, take the chance, and if there's, you know, if it goes against you, then there's some support. When you look at the money that the government is pumping into COVID recovery, and I support it in the main, I mean, you know, times like this is when the government has to step up, then this is really a drop in the bucket, but it does have an enormous impact.
Thanks, Amy, and thanks, Stu.
Thank you so much.
That's Stu Hartley, the underwriting manager at Kiwi-based events insurance company Event Cover. It's now 26 minutes past 4. And some people keep a formal blazer at the ready for that impromptu Zoom video meeting. Business up top, party down below. And an outfit's easy to change. But what if it's your face that you're worried about. A recent survey of 2,000 men and women in Australia found that nearly a third, 31%, have become more aware of their flaws because of video calling. I'll call them flaws. More than a quarter, 27% asked, were more judgmental about other people's facial features too. And talking to RNZ's business reporter Nona Palsier, here's what the chief executive of Australia-based Silk Laser, Martin Perelman, had to say.
The growth path of cosmetic injectables, so toxin and filler, is still growing at double-digit growth year on year, and I think there's a very long runway for those products. I mean, these products have been around for a long period as well, but they're just really coming into growth. What we're really seeing is body contouring is the hottest new thing at the moment in Australia, but for injectables and Botox and filler, that'll continue to grow because it's such a fairly non-invasive treatment and can reduce a wrinkle or bring back volume to someone's face that they may have lost due to aging. So it's a very easy treatment. So we think there's a lot of growth coming out of that category.
Body sculpting. Ellen, when you check yourself out on video, if indeed you do, perhaps you could describe to us what you see looking back at you.
Jowls. Jowls and chins. It's terrible. Body sculpting. I have no idea what the hell body sculpting is. But you're right. And there's a simple solution to this, everybody. Turn the camera off. It's easy.
So they can't see you.
Exactly. And you can't see yourself.
It's always a shock, isn't it? How do you get Zoom ready, Amy? How you frame, you're framing yourself
there? I've been caught out by that before. I went into one thinking I could go in with camera off and then realised it was a presentation just to me. And I'd gone on after my run thinking I can get away with going on instead of my sweaty running gear and got completely caught out. So, but look, I just found it's incredible how quickly I slot back into sloth mode. And as soon as lockdown's on, I find myself making very little effort. And it's a take me as you find me. And if anyone's shocked by that, well, too bad.
I have to say, those cameras, though, they're so revealing, aren't they? They look worse than you do in real life.
Yeah, they are. And I'm sure all of us spend more time looking at what our own picture looks like than the person talking to us, which is a bit sad, way more than we'd worry about it in a normal meeting. I think you just have to have a bit of a dose of, never mind, and move on. I don't know what the hell body contouring is.
No, body sculpting.
Body sculpting, was it? Yeah.
Contouring and sculpting. Perhaps somebody could let us know exactly what that is. Perhaps it's not something in reality. Maybe you do that with an app. Who knows? I'm sure you don't. It's coming up now to 4:30 and the headlines will be back after that.